Now, I want to start by going back 30 years, routine activity approach. It's pretty simple. It's something I did as a young professor. It was considered very strange at the time and maybe still. What it is it's argued that you can have, to study crime, you needn't worry so much about offenders. That indeed an illegal act involves an offender and a target and the absence of a guardian against the crime, that this is a physical convergence that has to occur. And if the physical convergence does not occur, then a normal crime does not occur. And as a result, the targets for crime may be more important than the offenders, and the guardians for crime may be more important than the people who would stop a crime, and I'll say something about them, than offenders. And the guardians are usually not police, but are usually everyday people who may be watching things like, this is your purse and you're there, watch it, so the guardian is present. And the physical convergences are extremely important for understanding crime opportunities. Now, since that time, I've elaborated, and John Eck has certainly helped to put this together. He's here. And I have considered not just the people who look after things like purses, but also the people who look after places, and that's John's addition, and the people who look after their kids. In other words, in effect, if you're committing a crime, you have to get away from your mother, get to the place where nobody's watching, and take the thing. Now, that means that you've got the offender has to escape the handler, as I call it, mother, teacher, somebody else whose presence would discourage the crime, go to a place with no place manager present, and commit a crime against a target where there's no guardian to protect the target. Hence, supervision, convergence become the central points. It's a physical process of supervision and a process of movement. And this makes crime a much more physical phenomenon, and it certainly flies in the face of a lot of what we would consider traditional criminology. John Eck, who's sitting right here, has put this together into X triangle, as I call it, although sometimes it's just called crime triangle or other sorts of things. And in effect, he puts in the it's two triangles, and in the middle he puts the three elements and then the supervision on the outside. Now, this is available on a very nice website for all of you to learn about the details of crime, and there are a couple of them, actually. There's the British one, the Crime Reduction Crime website, you'll find. JDI has one, Jill Dando Institute, but the American one that perhaps is the richest right now is popcenter.org, P-O-P-C-E-N-T-E-R, American spelling, .org, one word, popcenter.org, and put the W's in. And you'll not only get a substantial amount about the physical features of crime, opportunities to carry about crime, but also about very specific policies to prevent it, policies that are known as situational prevention. Situational prevention focuses on the very local conditions or very direct conditions that physically make it more difficult to carry out a crime. And increasingly, through work of a number of people, some of them in this room, we've discovered that crime prevented here does not simply pop up there, that displacement is not nearly the problem once thought of, and that crime really can be prevented substantially by rather direct methods, situationally and otherwise. I have a new book, which is called Crime in Nature. I'll have a couple copies tomorrow to give away, and I usually can get desk copies for people. And in it, I have, Crime in Nature, the title implies, I have begun to apply the life sciences and the concepts of the life sciences to crime. And there are a number of things I do, including borrowing concepts of the ecosystem, adaptation, symbioses, mutualisms, crime parasitisms, where offenders take a little of the time. I conceive of bullying as a parasitism. And I go through a substantial number of very specific sorts of things. Turns out that you have to know a fair amount about crime in order to actually adapt the biological, the life science concepts properly. And one of the things you have to know is that the genetics is not going to carry it for you, that the most important branches of the life sciences that help you are not the genetic branches, but rather the ones that emphasize movement of plants, of animals, and the physical interactions. In other words, the behavioral, basically the behavioral ecology is more important. And you also learn, or I would argue passionately, that the naturalist notion of biologists, that is their ability to very detailed terms to describe plants and animals, applies to describing crime. One of the things we find is that criminal acts are highly specific. There's at least 11 different types of auto theft. They're very different from one another behaviorally. Who's involved, when they happen, the types of cars, the mapping, they're all different. I shouldn't say that every single one is different from every other one, but there are substantial differences. And we find the prevention is very different, that what will prevent joyriding is very different from what prevents part stripping. And so, and how you think about it, and how you map it, and so on. And situational prevention has helped us, and routine activities, and the work of the Brandinghams in Canada has helped us to think out these details. Now, I'll give you an example from Stockholm. Stockholm is a city with low burglary rates, so you might say low crime city if you just look at burglary. It turns out they have high auto theft rates. And reason's pretty simple. In Stockholm, the buildings are next to each other. There's no side entry. There's no burglary when there's no side entry, very little burglary. But when everyone's parking on the street, there's lots of auto theft. So are the Swedes low in crime or high in crime? Well, it depends on which you look at. It turns out that overall they're pretty high in crime. And you find other things like that where when you disaggregate, you get very different patterns than when you throw everything together. Now, Pat, you know, started out with things together and then began to disaggregate. And if we'd given her another hour, she would have disaggregated for and explained more details. Okay, now I've divided crime into three stages, and then you can subdivide them. There's a prelude, an event, and an aftermath. That sounds pretty simple. Why should we make a big deal over that? Well, it turns out it clarifies a fair number of problems. Prelude, anything leading up to the crime, the event itself, the criminal event, and there's an aftermath to the event. Well, it turns out that some crimes, like homicide, depend on the aftermath. If I assault someone and, okay, they're taken to the hospital, and later they die, that becomes a homicide. And if they don't die, it's not a homicide. But what the criminal justice system does is it feeds the aftermath back into the incident, and it says this was a homicide. But it wasn't a homicide. It was an assault. Some assaults, people die. Most of them not. So homicide is really an outcome. It's not a crime from a behavioral viewpoint. It is a crime from a juridical viewpoint. And so when you divide events and study them, you find that things lead to outcomes that you didn't think of. Another example of this, headline in the newspaper says, man murdered for $1. Well, it turns out that the offender probably did not say, there's a guy who's got $1, I'm going to murder him. He probably said to himself, there's a guy who has $1,000, I'm going to fight him and get, or I'm going to get it and he'll give it to me without arguing. So, but he does argue, he ends up assaulting him, the guy ends up dying, and he takes the wallet and there's only $1. So neither the murder nor the amount were known to the offender beforehand. So when you parse it into the prelude, event, and aftermath, you start to see things clarifying. I've done some diagramming of criminal acts. This drives Pat crazy because if any of you over 40 or 50 has had learned diagramming sentences, who here has had to diagram sentence and forced to do it by your high school teacher? I basically diagrammed crimes in terms of the sentence where I separated I separated everything out and I put the motive in as a phrase, a modifying phrase. And I argue that every crime and every collection of crimes can't be diagrammed like you diagram a sentence with the immediate object plus the underlying motive plus, you know, I have a bunch of them in an appendix and so forth. Now, I'll say something quickly about thick crime habitat. I'm going through these concepts. There's no way I can cover it. I'm just giving you a little taste, a little flavor, like a smorgasbord. Okay, thick crime habitat is a concept term I've tried to describe, a place where the crime opportunities have gotten so thick that crime tends to take over the area. And when that happens, there's an interesting other side that to it, that supervision completely changes. See, in a normal neighborhood, supervision means that if I'm committing crimes, I may do so, but I have to conceal what I'm doing because I'll get in trouble. But when the crime has taken over the area, I don't have to conceal what I'm doing that much. But if you're going to turn me in, you better conceal what you're doing. So in a sense, it turns the tables where the people who have to conceal what they're doing are the ones who normally in other crimes would be on the other side. So in a sense, it's a way to look at supervision. Now, I mentioned, I have chapters on symbiosis, mutualisms, parasitisms, and so on. And I go through, borrowing from Peter Rabbit, from the originator of Peter Rabbit actually was the woman who figured out, the scientist who figured out what a lichens is. And I argue that certain types of racketeering are like lichens. That is, in effect, they're two different organizations that live together, depend on one another, provide different functions to each other, and that the corrupt Teamsters Union in the United States, the Truckers Union, the Teamsters Union, was, in effect, a lichens-like structure. You might call it a mutualism where multiple resources are being passed between the two and they're drawing from the larger side and other ideas like that. Now I'm going to push on. I've got several fallacies about crime, and they're in an early book, Crime and Everyday Life, and I have 10 of them. I'm just going to mention a few. The dramatic fallacy is emphasizing crimes that are most dramatic. If you read the newspaper, you get the dramatic crimes. They're completely unrepresentative. If you map crime based on what you read in the newspapers, you get something that will just be wrong. And so part of our resistance, we have to inoculate ourselves against the media, and we have to keep doing that because the media keep coming back at us. And the not me fallacy that I'm so good I don't commit a crime, but it turns out that most of us have. And the cops and courts fallacy, overstating criminal justice system power. And ingenuity fallacy, overstating the skill that an offender has. The one way I put it is offenders think, but not too much. They tend to be rational, a bit rational, but not that careful, a little careful. They have goals, they are goal-oriented, they make decisions, but that doesn't mean they think of everything or think way ahead. And so when you put it that way, you begin to understand a fair number of things. And the agenda fallacy, in a way, is the hardest, that almost everybody who talks about crime has some ideology, religious or political agenda that leads them to screw up their science. And if you have one, then you've got to get away from it if you want to make any real contribution. Probably have to get away from it. Although I have known people who were very deep believers in some agenda, in some view, who were able to continue being scientific. But they are exceptions. It's actually quite hard to do that. Now, what I want to do is turn to page 3 and 4, and I want to say some of the foraging principles. And there's no way I can get all of this, but I wrote 3 chapters on foraging in this book, and there's no way I can get over these 3 chapters or even one of them today, but I want to give a few ideas. First of all, we learn a whole lot from the biologists, the life scientists, about foraging, and their ideas can be very helpful. One of them is that they use the term relative generalist, that some organisms are relative generalists. I would argue that offenders are relative generalists. That is that most offenders, although there are exceptions, most offenders do not commit a narrow range of crimes, but a somewhat broader range, but they don't do everything. So there's a range of things they'll do, and the people who, even though for convenience we talk about the burglar, really the burglar probably does more non-burglaries than burglaries. And the same violent offenders tend to do mainly nonviolent crimes, but they just do more more likely to do violent crime. And so one of the things I didn't, I had in my notes, but I didn't say yet, is that prediction of offenders, prediction of people, is not only not very good, but it's not gotten any better in the last 60 years. So if any of you want to keep, want to build models predicting what who will be an offender or who will be a worse offender, you can do so, and you can dress it up, and you can get it published. But in the end, not only will your finding die with you, it will probably die with you the day after it's published. Or it won't, you will over, you will survive your findings. there's no, virtually no progress in prediction of individual behavior, individual offenders. There is a, there are, I can tell you the tricks though. One of the tricks is to predict afterwards. Predict backwards. And that does work. In other words, if you take the people who are in trouble at age 20, you can predict that they were in trouble at age 13. But if the ones who were in trouble at 13, you can't predict very well at all that they will be in trouble at age 20. Okay. And so, in effect, we've got a problem that we've got to be clever. And some of the people in this room, including the Branninghams and some of the others you're going to hear, have been quite clever at pushing beyond that and focusing on the events rather than individuals and bad guys and that sort of thing. Okay, now, an offender does not have to forage for crime. Some offenders stay put and crime opportunities come to them. Some offenders go around their normal daily routines and they come across crime opportunities. They don't need to change the routines, but some do change routines. That's the second point. Third, that offender foraging can be very general with unclear time crime targets or just to have fun. Now, I do not believe that most offenders say, I am always say, I'm going downtown in order to steal something, in order to break in a store, or in order to steal, I'm going to shoplift. They, particularly as they're younger, they're more likely to say, let's go downtown and have fun. So the kids are together, they go, they don't know that they're going to commit a crime. Or if they do, they don't know which crime. So very often foraging is more diffuse than that. Although as offenders get older and a little more experienced, they're a little more likely to forage with more direction. But don't overstate that, because offenders are not necessarily more directed. And as their substance abuse gets worse, sometimes they get fuzzier and fuzzier about what they're going to do. So, and they aren't all the same. I was quoting and talking to Henri. I was quoting Feynman, the physicist, who said the exception disproves the rule. If there's an exception, the rule's no good, or something along that line. And that we don't apply that in criminology and in general in the life sciences. There are exceptions. It's too hard to model things and come up with rules that are absolutely solid for everybody. So we've got to have exceptions, and we've got to deal with that. And if anyone can figure out a better way, please tell me. Okay. Now, foraging is relevant for crime in multiple ways. I've only gotten to four. Police do foraging. They forage for offenders. And when they forage randomly, they do very poorly. When they are highly focused in how they look for offenders, they can be much better. And there's been work on that. And I'll try to get to that in one of my models deals with that. We know that citizens, everyday people forage, like when you're shopping. And it may be that there's not much difference between foraging for shoplifting and for shopping and shoplifting. There's some of the rules are the same. And I can tell you some research along those lines, although there are also some different things. Now, I argue that Ron Clark's principles of crime, situational crime prevention fit within a foraging model, that in effect you make offenders forage more difficultly, make it so they can't get to the crime opportunities as easily, and you cut down on their efficiency, and some of them may even quit or quit for periods of time. And foragers risk their own victimization, including foraging offenders. That comes right out of the life sciences. Foraging animals who have to worry about themselves being eaten, Well, in this case, if you forage and you have to worry about getting caught or worry about police or something like that. So there's some difference between younger offenders who forage more in groups. There are a bunch of principles like this that are interesting. The Outsiders Insiders Thing 8 is Pat Brannigan's point, and you really should read Pat and Paul's work on that. You have to think about at least four ways that if you have an area rich in crime targets, you not only make entirely new offenders, you get former offenders to return to the fold. You get occasional offenders to increase what they do. You get active offenders to become more efficient at crime. And so there are multiple ways in which you might be feeding a crime through crime foraging. Now we're on page 4. We have to distinguish overt from covert crimes. This is one of my clever ideas. I want to see if anyone else will think it clever. The distinction between violent and nonviolent crimes is common. I think it's a bad idea. I think it's the wrong distinction. It's too moral, too much of it based on morality and too little on the reality. And the reality is overt versus covert. There are property crimes that are covert and property crimes that are overt. If I kick in your window and there are people who hear the noise, that's an overt crime. And even if it's not violent, it draws attention to me. If violence is usually overt because you have a victim you're violent to, but it isn't always overt because sometimes the victim's unable to identify you or something of that sort, so and there's nobody around. So the issue is really overtness versus covertness. And if you do an overt crime, you need different circumstances than covert. So I think that the difference between overtness and covertness is much more important than violent versus nonviolent. I think it's more to the point. Those violence gets close to that. Okay, so maybe it's a good idea. Now, I've distinguished criminal acts that are directly known I have a kind of a sequence that is your crime known beyond your personal circle? Is it just known to yourself? The ideal crime is just known to you. I steal something, no one did an inventory, they don't even know it's gone. No one ever discovers it. I'm home free. That's the ideal crime. The worst is that everybody knows that I did the crime. That's the last on the scale, and they're in between. And some family violence and so on, the family may know, but they may not want to tell anyone. So I think there's a kind of a scale. 12, usually you don't forage for something you can't carry. This is the maximum size rule translated into crime. But you can use vehicles and accomplices to overcome a limited, extend your reach. And so this is comes right out of biological, foraging theory. And search and handling time, some of you will recognize that. And as you forage further away, you expect more gains. That comes right out of the theory, right out of findings in biological literature. And so forth. So the idea is to disrupt foraging and then you can reduce crime. Now, start on my models. Okay, model 1. Now here's what I did to screw up this model. Let me tell you how to unscrew it. You cross out A, B, and C, equations A, B, and C, and if you go down a bit, I think I confused which is non-cash and cash. Below, I think I put I should have put non-cash. In which non-cash burglaries? Yes, under initial burglaries, it says of which it should be non-cash burglaries are blah blah blah. Now let me just explain it. And I also should have really used a small p for proportion. I just haven't been doing this thing for too many years. I haven't been dealing with equations for many years. But I think the logic is there, and I'm gonna try to rescue this. And I don't know why I didn't notice it. The others will be better. But the basic idea is, okay, we got 1,000 burglaries. Those burglaries set up a certain number of other crimes. All right, let's start with, some of them are non-cash burglaries, so they're goods that have to be fenced. Okay, if there are 406 goods that are fenced, so I'm the burglar, I sell to my fence, George. That's a second crime. And if George buys it, that's a third crime. And if George resells it, that's a fourth crime. So we've got four stages, total them up, calculate what they are, and we've got, total them up, and we've got a multiplier. What's the multiplier for a burglary? And I come up with a multiplier given certain assumptions of 2.177. That is, that 1,000 burglaries will create 2,177 crimes, including the first sale, the purchase of the stolen goods knowingly, and then a resale knowingly. But the person who buys stolen goods not knowingly, that's usually not a crime. So, in effect, you've got the logic of it. I gave some equations. I had some proportions to try to estimate what proportion are, you know, resold, what proportion are not, and so forth. And that's the logic of it. And I just didn't really put it down very nicely. But okay, there you go. Now let's go to model two. Drug abuse, three groups. We know that people are not all absolutely drug addicts or not drug addicts. Rather, some people are very compulsive, some are somewhat, some are halfway, and some are just recreational drug users, can go either way. They'll take it or leave it. And basically, I define three groups, 30, 40, 30 in terms of proportion and, you know, in how much they abuse. I have so many thefts a day that you got, that each of them does. I start out with a total of 1,210 thefts per day for 1,000 abusers. Then I said, well, if you make it harder to do the crimes, the thefts, then the group A does the same number of thefts and still, you know, finds some until they have enough to keep their habit going. Group B is less obstinate, and group C is much less obstinate. And I just made some assumptions and got a 20% reduction in crime. It would probably be much more reduction than that, but there are some assumptions. You get the logic of it, you see the sorts of things you can simulate, that you can modify the assumptions and get a kind of a model. Now, model three, street prostitution and robbery. Let's say you've got 400 acts of prostitution in an area in some period of time. That actually produces many more crimes, mostly nonviolent, but some will be violent, will be robberies. And this is, doesn't even cover all the linked crimes, but this just gives you an example. First of all, you need more solicitations than there are actual acts. Second, you can double count because your solicitation and can go either way. And each act of prostitution you can double count too because they're both you know, depending on the legal system. And of course, in other countries, this may not. By the way, where prostitution's legal, they still have illegal prostitution because they're underage. Prostitutes, the street prostitution isn't legal. Certain things aren't legal, so you you still have these issues. And then I have some robberies, prostitutes by Johns and Johns by prostitutes, and indirect involvement setups, and then some unlinked robberies where guys hang around and just rob people in the area, but they aren't linked to the prostitutes. And total them all up, and I get several thousand crimes going beyond the 400 acts with double counting. So you have to know whether you're double counting or not double counting, and it's kind of a model, easily complicated, and so forth. All right. Now, Vancouver. Pat and Paul Branningham made a mistake of hosting me there, and so I'm going to write some things about their fair city without their permission. Okay. They have an easy needle policy, which includes at least three elements. I hope I got it right. Needle exchange, which we also have in some American places. Nurse-administered illegal drugs on Skid Row. In other words, you can walk into the health center and the nurse will help you administer your heroin or whatever it is. And they'll actually do it safely, correct? Is that it? Cocaine. It's all cocaine. Okay. They'd probably help you with heroin if you asked. Oh, that's another office. Okay. And then the cheap needles purchased in the pharmacy easily, legally, etc. And so you can, whereas in our country it's hard to purchase hypodermics there, you just walk in and they'll give you some with complete advice which one's better for which drugs. Now, I argue, by the way, they think they're very enlightened there. The Canadians like to do things the opposite of Americans, whatever it is, because Americans are unenlightened, so if they do the opposite, that makes them enlightened. But I don't get this from the Brannighams. They don't say this, but other Canadians. So in a very short-run sense, they're probably correct that in one single injection, your risk is probably greater this side of the border than that side, because they're more likely to be safer needles, and also because they have more chance that a nurse will administer it, and so on. So if the number of injections never increased, then their system definitely would be much better. But if the number of injections and people involved increases, then it can push the other direction. That's what my model says. I have a total drug abuser population. Your T, also a T minus one last year's drug abuse population. I've got six components: the new drug abusers, the death, literal death of drug abusers, the desisters who don't die but desist, the in-migration of drug abusers, and the out-migration of drug abusers, local area. So I've got six components. I rearranged the equation. And my argument is that even if some of these components reduce the drug abuse, the other components increase it, particularly in migration, new local users, because it's so easy, easy to recruit and easy to use, less desistance. They do have less deaths, probably have less deaths. However, that means they also have more people survive in the next year. So you could argue they're slowing down the deaths of people. So they're drawing it out. That's a nasty way of putting it, but I somewhat suspect. Basically, I don't like their policy. I think it's a mistake. But I think the worst part of the policy, this is all my intuition, the worst part of the policy, I think, is the pharmacy part. That is, I think the pharmacy part is spreading too many needles. Now, this is all empirically worth testing. It's actually rather complicated because there's six components. There's several components of this. But I have a simulation. You can change all your assumptions and get different results. It's something someone can work with. A mathematician can work with. Now let's go to model five. Am I over? I have
you a few. Have, 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay, model five, social spread of drug abuse.
Or maybe 5 minutes.
All right, I'll try to do it pretty fast. And I'm around if there's somebody I'm confused about. I'll try to straighten it out if I can. Okay, social spread of drug abuse. Okay, this is drawn from there's a British ethnographer who's done some very interesting work, and his name is too easy a name, so I'm forgetting it for the moment. But I cited my work, and I'll come up with it probably in a minute. And he studied the different ways that young Britons use drugs. It's very, very interesting, because it turns out that let's say some kids go to a party and they're smoking pot. A fair number of kids will smoke a little, but they'll never buy it. Then you got kids who, they'll share in the price, but they will never go outside and buy it from a stranger. Then you got those who will buy only from familiar people. They will go outside and buy it, but only familiar people. And then there are people who will actually go to relative strangers in public places or relative strangers in unfamiliar private places. So you've got, there actually a scale of about 10. I cut it down to about 5 to simplify this model. Now, my argument is that all the drugs come from 4 or 5 indirectly. In other words, let's say I'm a kid in a party, okay, I'll smoke a little. Whatever I smoke or drink or whatever I ingest by whatever means came from somewhere. And if it's an illegal substance, it probably came from 4 or 5. Okay. So if 4 or 5 were cut off, it would indirectly cut off 1, 2, and 3. And similarly, if 1, 2, and 3 were cut off, it would cut down on a lot of the business for 4 and 5. So there's a linkage between those two parts of the list. Okay. Now, it turns out we probably have the most policy power on 4, that is, to cut down drug sales in public places. It turns out there's a fair amount that can be done. And I basically calculated, you know, a little bit of simulation. If you can cut down, did I say 70% or something like that, of the drugs in category 4, if 70% come from that and you can cut down 30% of those, what would that do? I mean, or 20%, I think they may have said, something like that. And basically, what would the multiplier be through, in other words, how much of the first 3 types would it cut down? And that's what it's about. It's a pretty simple concept. Okay. I didn't allow feedbacks in this one, in other in other words, I'm saying only 1 of the 5 is offering real policy options, at least in this model. So focus on that. What would it do? By the way, you can also link the burglary and the drug together and actually have a set of equations that are rather like an econometric model where there are multiple crimes interacting with and feeding into one another. And I could write out a set of equations, hopefully better than I wrote the first set, that would theoretically tell you how they would link over time. But the thing is, it couldn't be a monthly or a yearly model. It would have to be almost a daily model. In other words, it would be very hard to actually get the data. And so simulation becomes, you almost need to take data from pieces of it and then simulate from there. You know, it's from a starting point. You would have trouble getting data in some of these models for every stage, but you would not have trouble getting data at parts of it and then see whether you get somewhere. Or whether it fits. Now, Model 6, fractal-like spread of crime. I've got 5. Okay. This, I don't have an answer. I merely have a problem. How did this happen? D, I present D first. I'll get to A, B, and C. You've got a drug, open-air drug market, a bigger one, and then 4 smaller ones, and you got a bunch of drug buyers around and then drug-related thefts around. In other words, you've got a deteriorated area. How did you get there? That's D. Now let's go to A, B, and C. If you start with a kind of a C, this is semi-fractal. It's not fully fractal in the sense that it's exactly, I'm not insisting that there be exactly self-same properties for the mathematicians in the room. So basically, I think if you start with one market, and this is borrowed really this idea from George, and I hope I did it right. I just did the artwork, but the thinking, I think, is George's, where you start from one drug market and a certain amount of crime feeds into that, then that crime goes out and softens the surrounding area. Then there's enough for a second drug market, and the first one also enlarges. And as this happens and leapfrogs out, you get a spread of crime and drugs that sort of takes over an area. And that's really, in a way, how you get fit crime habitat. Also, you get destruction in an area in some sort of a semi, some sort of recurring way. Now, to get all the data at each stage, I don't know how you do that. I think, again, this is, you can get data at some of the stages, perhaps. Although Pat Brainingham probably has all the data at all stages because she's got data, she and Paul have data nobody else has. Okay, Model 7, abandonment and supervision of space. Here we've got, I'm very much into abandoned property. I think abandoned properties or semi-abandoned property are very important. The simplest example of abandonment or semi-abandonment is you're being away from home and being burgled during the day while you're away. That's a semi-abandonment, but you go back. home, and so the whole neighborhood, if most people are coming back, the whole neighborhood is far from abandoned, but there are times when they will be abandoned. If you have a neighborhood where there are neighborhoods where properties are totally abandoned, and I modeled first, first I have three properties that are occupied full-time, three that are occupied half-time, and no abandoned under A, case A, and there'd be very little problem there because there are people around, very little burglary, very little crime. There may be at the edge a little bit of risk and so on, where the asterisk is a little bit of danger, but that may be even exaggerated there. B, you get more abandoned, more half-occupied and one abandoned property, and you start getting more risks. And then when there's most of the properties are abandoned or semi-abandoned, then there's more risk, and that's the basic idea. And this is defined from right of the work on supervision of space.
Marcus, why don't you stop there and ask the audience which are the next models they want to see?
Good, fair.
Does anybody have a preference on, because I don't think you can go over them all in 1 minute.
Right.
I'm sorry?
Found them in the space.
All right. Well, that's I thought I did. That's about all I have to say, except on it is what I just said. Seven. Except I have a table in which I in my book the 11 ways that abandoned space creates crime, but I can't remember them all. But I can tell you some of them. If there's nobody, if you have an abandoned property, you not only are crimes committed in, people come in and steal things from it, strip the copper and so on. They commit crimes inside. There may be prostitutes who pick up people and then they go inside, or drug people go inside and use drugs so it can be used for illegal activity. There's no more supervision of the street, so people will get mugged on the street because there's no one watching the street. Except the offenders in a way, and people walk down the street are highly vulnerable. And I mean, those are a sample of the 11 things, ways that it. Also, one other, you can have a hangout for gangs. So you meet, get your accomplices, go out and commit crimes elsewhere, but that's kind of that's what keeps the cauldron boiling. So they're really, abandoned property, I argue, is the central feature almost in inner city deterioration and crime, feeding crime. And not poverty, because if you've got poor people, but they're there, and the properties aren't abandoned, they tend not to have high crime rates.